Okay, good afternoon. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me with the, is the sound okay? Same thing as, yeah, okay. I'll try to put this a bit higher here. Eventually, I'll get used to it again. I don't usually like microphones, but in a room of this size, it's difficult not to use them. Good. Welcome to lecture 2, Ling 101. We will continue. We will continue from where we left off, where we stopped last time. We will be talking much more about language today. What is language? But in particular, about what is the difference between human and animal communication. I'm sure many of you know what's here on the main page, on the front page, or on the first slide, the honeybees dance, and that's just one of the things that I'm going to talk about. Okay, now let's see. I'll first make a couple of announcements, and then the bulk of the lecture will be concerned with human versus animal communication. I will then say a few more things about, or a few things about English spelling. Because that's, in a way, at the very bottom, well, not at the very bottom, but we will, there is a connection between English spelling and what we're going to do next week. Okay. And I'll end with some fundamental linguistic concepts, in particular, the distinction between prescriptive and descriptive linguistics. Okay, but first a few announcements, and this is not going to be anything like last week where we had a lot to discuss. Okay, the first lecture, or the materials from the first lecture, are now online on StudIP in the sense of the slides. There's a PDF of the slides, and the lecture recording is also online. Can I just have some feedback? I mean, has anyone tried downloading it, and has it worked? Has it not worked for someone? Sorry? It's worked. Okay. Yeah. Now, obviously, I can't. Yeah?
The quality of the MP4 file is not the best.
Yeah.
It's hard to read.
Is it hard to read? Yeah. I mean, the problem is that there's a limit for the size that I can upload. And I can try to make it a little bit better. I mean, what you can also do is, of course, have the PDF separately and then follow just the audio. That's the other option. I'll see what I can do. I can try to increase the quality a little bit. It just gets quite a lot bigger then. Yeah. Okay. But, I mean, that should be there. It is there, and it seems to be working. The URL, the location of the file... files will change, as I've already announced. I'm still setting up the password-protected site. I have some technical issues there. I will then announce this on StudIP if the location has changed. Okay. Okay, I've solved that. Any problems accessing the files don't seem to be... Can you see this? Is this bright enough? Is it okay? Okay, good. Now, many of you will have become a little bit more familiar with StudIP as a system. There are various things in there that you can use. You can use it to send emails to each other and to me. There's also something known as StudIP chat. Now, I'm not proposing that we chat on a regular basis, okay? But occasionally, you will find me logged in there, and if there is a question, then you could also ask this via the chat. Okay. Now, the 5 tutorials, and this is actually where an apology is, I think, due now from my side. There are 5 tutorials, as announced last week, but many of you may have tried to attend those tutorials this week and found out that it's actually only starting next week, which you didn't know. This is something that I forgot to announce last week. We agreed that it would only make sense to start next week. I really apologize for not letting you know this earlier. It's a bit late now, I know. They will definitely start next week. If you have not signed up, then it's basically too late for you to do this, which means that we now have to manually add you. If this is the case for you, and you really would like to attend the tutorial but haven't been able or haven't signed up, I know that there was an issue also that it wasn't easy to find it first until I moved it to the right place. Anyway, to cut the long story short, if you can't get in, if you would like to be added to one tutorial, send me an email. And the important thing is, send me the email, send me your matricul number, send me your immatriculation number, because that's what I need to add you to the course. Okay. Right. I'd just like to repeat that again. Check your unitria.de email address. Okay. Just as a reminder, this is going to be the last time I'm saying this. And then something else, something not related to the course as such. I got an email from a colleague who's working at in Michigan at the university there in Ann Arbor, and she's asked me whether she could send me a questionnaire or a link to a questionnaire to be filled in by, people like you, proficient speakers of English but second language learners of English, of mother tongue, whose mother tongue is German. Okay, so if your mother tongue is German, then please have a look at the link that I will post on StudIP. You don't get any brownie points for it. You don't get any credit points for it. It's just basically a colleague of mine asking for help because over there in Ann Arbor, it's more difficult to find native speakers of German. And she's asked me to forward that link to you. There's no obligation to do this, but it would be nice if a couple of or some of you would do this. Okay, any questions regarding practicalities? Yeah? The library exercise will follow probably sometime next week to make sure that those people who are not present here will be able to see it at the same time, and there will be a deadline which is sufficiently long. I mean, there's a good week to do this, so don't worry about that. Okay? Yeah? You do not necessarily have to bring it to the lecture, I would say. But I would, and this is actually something that the tutorial teachers have asked me to say, I would strongly recommend that you bring your material to the tutorials, because that's where you're going to actively work with it and do the exercises. Okay, any other questions? Yes. No tutorials have, as far as I know, been cancelled. It's 21 on Monday now. Okay. So, maybe you were early and other people haven't done that yet. So, no, all 5 tutorials are, as far as I know, running. Okay. Other questions? If not, let's do some linguistics. Okay. And I'd like to briefly come back, and for a completely different reason. I'd briefly like to come back to, what I've just basically abbreviated here as the N-word that I mentioned last. Thank you. That I mentioned last week, and I gave you this kind of information orally. Okay, I didn't actually put this on a slide. And I'd just like to, I'm not even going to repeat this now. But I thought I'd briefly mention this again because it gives me an opportunity to introduce you to something which many of you will, I'm sure, already know. But the question is basically, where can you find this information? Okay. Apart from Wikipedia, maybe. Where is a good source for finding this kind of language-related information related to the history of a particular word? Okay. Well, obviously in a good dictionary. But a good dictionary that includes etymological information about the history and the development of words. Now, the one that I recommend that you use for this kind of purpose is probably known to you already. It's the Oxford English Dictionary. Okay. And if you have not been able to use this before, where you went to school, etc., then you may not know that there is a good online interface to this, which looks like this. Here I looked for the word African-American. And you can look at various things, including pronunciation, a date chart, etc. And then there is also something up here which is not selected by default, which says etymology. And then you get information about where it comes from. And sometimes you get more information about the meaning of words. This is easily available over the internet if you are connected to the university network. Okay. If you're not connected to the university network, and this is true for a number of resources that you will have access to, you won't get access to them unless you connect via VPN. Okay. There's a client that you can use to do this. This is too technical now for the lecture. I don't want to go into any detail. It is possible to be somewhere outside of the university, somewhere down in Trier or in New Zealand, it doesn't really matter where, and pretend that you are connected to the university network. If you have any questions about that, the Rechenzentrum or ZIMC will be able to help you. Can I turn up? Turn down the light. Okay. I can try. There's usually the spot where it then sort of completely turns off, so let's see. Is that okay? Okay, good. Right. That was basically a few words about last lecture, but I'd really like to go over now to the new topic for today, namely human versus animal communication. And here's the quote again from last week with the important thing highlighted. Language is a purely human and non-instinctive method of communicating ideas, emotions, and desires, etc., etc. And we've already briefly indicated last week that, well, clearly animals do communicate. And I already told you last week that I would like to look at both types of communication and maybe use this as a way of finding out what is particular about human communication. Okay, so what's the difference? In order to start this, I would like to give you a couple of communication examples from different animals. Let's start with spiders. Okay? Yes. Now, what they do to communicate in some way, okay, we have to ask ourselves to what this is the same type of communication as we perform when we communicate with friends, etc. They sort of vibrate, okay, on their webs. Okay? For example, to indicate to a fellow spider, no, I am not food, please do not eat me. Okay. Also, I'm the right sort of spider to mate with you. So don't only not eat me, but you might be interested in something else. Okay. Interestingly, these signals are actually apparently sometimes abused by other spiders, okay, who would like to eat the spider. Mm-hmm. There seems to be something going on in terms of communication. Okay. But I think everyone intuitively agrees that this is rather different, for example, much more limited, I would say, than what goes on in human communication. Okay, let's leave the spiders. I don't know enough about spiders to go on here. The honeybee. As I'm sure many, if not all of you know, honeybees have a very complex way of communicating where they found a particular source of food. Okay. They have this, well, it looks a bit like a dance. Okay. They have a dance, and depending on how they dance, and again, I can't really go into any great detail, this will tell the other bees where the food can be found. Okay. So they fly around, find food, get back to the hive, dance around, and all the others will then go and get some food. Okay. There are actually three possible patterns. They're called round, sickle, and tail wagging, and the choice depends on the distance to the food source. Okay. And the angle to the sun, I'll show this to you on the next slide, depends on the direction of the source. So depending on how the honeybee um, sort of how the head of the honeybee is located to the relation to the sun will tell the other bees something about where it is. Okay, and then depending on how with how much effort the bee dances, this tells something about the quality of the food. Okay. Here, just briefly, this is what it looks like. The important thing is the degree. So, for example, if the flowers are over there, there is a 30 degree to the sun with respect to the hive, etc. And that will give bees information about where to go next. Okay. Right, I'd like to finish with the bees already, and I'd like to move over to birds. In what way do birds communicate? We all know about bird song. Okay. And that seems to indicate mate attraction, let's call it like that, or territory defense. This is my tree. Okay. Don't come anywhere close. And everyone who's ever listened to a bird, or at least to some species, know that this can be extremely complex. All sorts of ups and downs and melodious patterns. Okay. So they can be very complex, but it's apparently, and this is, we have to believe scientists here, really only the pitch, whether it's high pitch or low pitch, which makes sense in terms of bird communication. Okay. Again, a change in the pattern may be communicative, so for example, if someone is really, or if a bird is really annoyed about the other bird, then it'll sound slightly differently, maybe higher pitched, or the difference might be bigger. Okay? So we have the spiders, we have the bees, we have the birds. Right, primates. They appear to perform much more demanding tasks when it comes to cognitive effort that's involved. In fact, some monkeys have been observed to lie. Okay. To lie or to deceive fellow monkeys to sort of make sure that only they can get the source of the food. Okay. So what about language? Okay. Now, from a physiological point of view, we can't expect them to do what we do, namely speak with our vocal cords, what we're going to talk about over the next 2 weeks. So they cannot speak properly in the sense of human voice-based speech. Okay. And I think you read this in Finnegan. There's actually, that was, I think, the story of Nim that's in Finnegan, but there's also Vicky from the 1950s, which was a female chimp. And they took months and months, or possibly even years, and the result was rather frustrating. It was 4 words that this poor animal was able to pronounce, one of them being cup, but the U wasn't actually voiced. It sounded more like cup, cup, or something like that. Okay, right. Mama, papa, up and cup. So quite clearly, based on the vocal, on the abilities of the vocal tract, we would have to say that monkeys or primates can't talk. But people have gone on to look at the use of sign language as the more promising approach. And that's actually, sorry, I mixed this up, that was actually Nim. No, here's another chimp. I'm mixing, as I told, I think I told you before, my memory for names is really bad. So I even mix up chimpanzees. Okay. This chimpanzee acquired 132 signs. And the important bit, it's not just the signs, but it's also the combination of those signs. Okay. So it's not just learning a particular sign to mean banana, but that chimpanzee would have been able to, let's say, banana and then together with a verb or something like that. Let's say eat. Okay. Yeah. Or in fact, something like water bird for swan, okay, which makes sense. So this kind of suggests that there is a continuum. Spiders clearly are very limited in their way of communicating, while primates are much more advanced. So this may suggest that there is a continuum, in fact. And then there's Kanzi. Okay. He has been trained by Sue Savage Rumbo, okay. And he's really quite special, and he's also now got a son or a daughter, I can't remember, and they're also training them to speak. Well, to speak using symbols, to communicate using symbols. And these are the symbols that they use. Okay. Now, can you guess what this means? No, I can't either. To be honest, I don't know what it means. Okay. And that's the whole point. There is no connection, no immediate connection for most of those symbols between what they mean and what they look like. Okay. I'll come back to that point when I talk about human communication. Interestingly, Kanzi is also able to understand instructions, okay. Understand instructions spoken in human voice. Okay. And he will then react to them even though the instructions may actually be rather silly. Okay. Now, for those of you who are listening to the lecture, this will now go, this is, you're probably not going to show, you're not going to see the video that I'm going to show. For those of you who can't be present, just do a YouTube search for Kanzi, and then you will see that for yourself. But those of you who are here can now have a quick look at what's going on when Kanzi communicates, not with using the symbols, but actually reacts to human input. And then we can decide whether there is communication going on. Let's see whether this works.
Kanzi? Could you cut the onions with your knife? Well, that's very good. Thank you. Could you put some salt on your ball? Well, that's a good job. Very nice. Thank you.
Kanzi, can you put the pine needles in the refrigerator?
Why would you want to do that?
Good job. Thank you. Kanzi, are you listening? Could you put some soap in the water?
It's more like the instructions.
Good job. Thank you. Could you listen again? Kanzi, could you pour a little coke in the water?
Okay, etc., etc. Notice that she was wearing a mask, okay? So that you can't say that this is because of expressions, facial expressions, or possibly even lip reading or something like that. It was purely based on whatever the auditory or the vocal instructions. So quite clearly, animals do have a level of, well, an ability to communicate, even using human interaction. Okay. Now, I think it is fair to say that it is difficult to define language that everyone agrees with the definition. Okay? But maybe we can come up with a number of criteria that are sort of, that everyone can agree with are part of human language. Okay? And in particular, certain criteria that maybe, not maybe, that clearly differ from the way, or that are unique to human interaction. This is something that Charles Francis Hockett came up with in the 1950s. Okay. And I'd like to go through six of those properties now with you. The first one is displacement. The question is basically whether animals can talk about something that is not around them in their immediate environment. Okay. Can a cat communicate about an event that lies in the past? Last night in the park, I met this really nice other cat. And okay, is that possible? Okay. And we believe that this is not possible for a cat. If a cat meows, then that's to communicate something or an immediate need now, okay? And not a comment on the quality of the food from last night. Okay. Can any animal talk about things that are not present? Well, I think yes, to some extent, in a very limited way. The example of the honeybee's dance is actually a case of displacement, because basically the honeybee communicates about something that is not in the immediate here and now. However, it is limited. It's the most recent food source. The honeybee can't say, yeah, but the one that we found last week was much better. Okay? Now, the human communicative system and human communication as such allows for this displacement. We can talk about things that are in the past and the future, and in fact, we can talk about things that are not here and probably never will be, like Santa Claus or unicorns, etc. Okay? So that was number one, displacement. The second one is productivity. Human language is thought to be open-ended. It's an open-ended system of communication, and the important bit is it can be adapted to new situations. Okay. If we go back to the bees, is that true for them? Well, some really nasty experiments have been carried out in the past. For example, they made sure that a bee found a nice source of food but couldn't fly anymore. So would have been seriously restricted in terms of getting back to the beehive. Okay. The bee made it, okay, walking, I guess, okay, and communicated the distance in a different way. Namely, it completely misjudged distance, okay, because it took much longer to fly home. And it wasn't able to adapt to the new situation. Or, this is probably a nice way to get bees really angry, they put a food source on top of a tower, took a bee up there, and then let it fly back to the hive. And the bee communicated the location, and everyone went there, namely to the bottom of the tower. Okay, and then they probably got angry because there was no food. Okay. Because, well, to put it in a nutshell, there is no word for up in bee language. Okay. Now, this is perhaps not surprising, but the important point in this connection is even if there isn't one, no, not even if there isn't one, if there isn't one, they can't invent one for app. Okay. So it's not productive in that sense. Okay. Now the example with swan and lake bird, I think the case of the primate who did this, is actually an example of productivity of some kind. Okay, the next one, the third one, cultural transmission. The standard question to ask in this context is what happens when a child of two Chinese parents or Indian parents or whatever is adopted by two Tamil parents? Okay, the child will grow up speaking Tamil and not Chinese, even though ethnically speaking, it's a Chinese child. What happens to a piglet that's adopted by a dog? Does happen. Okay. Yes. Okay. It does happen. Okay. Well, quite obviously, the pig will not start barking. Yeah. There is something about, well, okay, the vocal tracts and everything, but also there's something about the ability to communicate that is limited by the kind of species that's involved. Okay. Now, it seems that humans have a kind of blueprint in their head that enables them to learn a language, okay, some kind of universal faculty that allows them to learn any language that's spoken in the world. But in this blueprint, which is genetic, the language is not specified. So depending on the input they get, any child will learn any language. Okay. Now, BERT seem to be able to adapt to the situation a little bit as well. For example, birds that live near loud cities have been known to adapt their bird song to this, but it's not the same. Okay. Also, we need to stress the importance of input for language learning. An animal will usually start producing the sounds they make without input from other animals because it is instinctive, while a child who doesn't grow up with language around them will not learn language. Okay, but then I found this. This was recently in the news.
All right, a story that will warm your little heart this morning.
That little mewling noise, if you will, you just heard was Rocky the squirrel actually purring, thankful that a mommy cat took him into her fold. You see, one day Rocky fell out of his nest, so he was introduced to a mommy cat named Emily. Emily quickly adopted Rocky. Now the couple has several family members, including a purring squirrel.
I think that's so cool.
A squirrel learning to purr from the little kitties. That would speak against what I've just said, right? So I got suspicious. I went to check on the internet. I went to the squirrel board, yes, which is a forum for squirrel lovers. Okay, and there was, of course, a question. Do gray squirrels purr? Because that person noticed that one of the baby squirrels that they found made sort of purring-like noises. Yes, they purr. Some do it loudly. My Henry just vibrates, and I can almost hear it. When he does it, I know he's very content and happy. Squirrels can make or hear noises as frequencies most humans can't hear. Who knows how many little sounds they make? So, yes, squirrels do purr, and no, the squirrel did not learn how to purr from the little kittens. Okay. So I think it still stands what I said. Okay, the fourth feature, discreteness. This is getting a little bit more complex. Sounds that we use to create language or to communicate are what's known as meaningfully discrete. Okay. If I say pit, then you will understand pit. Okay. If I say bit, then that's no problem for you to understand what I mean. Okay. But if I do something in between, then you will think that it's either bit or pit, and you'll make up your mind. There is no, it's either or. Okay. Each sound is treated as discrete, although there is, of course, a continuum. I can create a continuum, but we will assume that it is either the one or the other. This doesn't seem to be the case for animal communication. Next one, duality. Okay. And duality refers to the fact that human interaction or human communication seems to have not just one level. What do I mean by one level? Well, if you look at the words top, pot, and opt, then these are three English words. And they consist of the same, letters or sounds. Okay? I'll make the distinction between letters and sounds later on. Okay. So something that is made up of smaller parts, depending on how you put the parts together, can result in something different. So, and this basically goes through the whole structure of the language. Complex messages are made up of smaller parts. A limited set of sounds can be used to produce something which is really infinite, the ways we can combine words and sounds together. Okay. True for animal communication? No, not really. A dog's barking, let's just say it's woof, okay, or wow, or whatever you want to call it, then it'll be woof and not foo or something like that. Okay? Some people call this double articulation. Okay, last week I... Yes?
The question, if you take that ability,
Is it what? Sorry, is it?
Are those just three different words and not one complex message? I don't understand.
They are three different words, but they are made up of the same elements put in different order. And the fact that... Now, last week, I ended with a little story. Okay, I'd like to give you another story. Not like last week, but here is a story even in German. Okay, and I'd like to make a point with that. I don't know whether you know Peter Bichsel's Ein Tisch ist ein Tisch. If you don't, here is the beginning. Immer derselbe Tisch, sagte der Mann. Dieselben Stühle, das Bett, das Bild. Und dem Tisch sage ich Tisch, dem Bild sage ich Bild. Das Bett heißt Bett und den Stuhl nennt man Stuhl. Warum denn eigentlich? Die Franzosen sagen dem Bett Lit, dem Tisch Table, nennen das Bild Tableau und den Stuhl Chaise. Und sie verstehen sich. Und die Chinesen verstehen sich auch. Warum heißt das Bett nicht Bild, dachte der Mann und lächelte. Dann lachte er, lachte, bis die Nachbarn an die Wand klopften und Ruhe riefen. Jetzt ändert es sich, rief er und sagte von nun an dem Bett Bild. Ich bin müde, ich will ins Bild, sagte er. Und morgens blieb er oft lange im Bild liegen und überlegte, wie er nun dem Stuhl sagen wolle, und er nannte den Stuhl Wecker. Hier und da träumte er schon in der neuen Sprache, und dann übersetzte er die Lieder aus seiner Schulzeit in seine Sprache, und er sang sie leise vor sich hin. Er stand also auf, zog sich an, setzte sich auf den Wecker und stützte die Arme auf den Tisch. Aber der Tisch hieß jetzt nicht mehr Tisch, er hieß jetzt Teppich. Am Morgen verließ der Mann also das Bild, zog sich an, setzte sich an den Teppich, auf den Wecker und überlegte, wem er wie sagen könnte. This is, I think, a nice example of the fact that there is something we call arbitrariness in language. Okay. Usually there is no connection. The word usually is important, but usually there is no natural connection between what a word means and what it looks like. Okay. Remember the kanji symbols that I showed you. That's also the case there. There is no immediate connection between their meaning and their form. Okay. And people have observed that language is a system of such arbitrary signs. Sign being, well, it's sort of a general word, for example, the word table for, well, this thing here. Okay. And each language has its own conventions. Each community makes up their own uses of signs and symbols or signs for particular elements that they would like to name. Okay. And these need to be learned. They need to be learned by children growing up in that language or by second language learners learning a foreign language. Okay. Now, this seems not to be the case for animal communication, which is usually iconic. There's usually an immediate relationship between the sound and the meaning, well, not an immediate, well, to a greater extent. Okay. The meaning is somehow representative, the form is somehow representative of the meaning. Okay. But as I said, with Kanzi's set of arbitrary symbols, this shows that animals seem to be at least able to acquire, or some animals seem to be able to acquire an arbitrary system as well. Okay, from time to time throughout the lecture course, you're going to get some cartoons from me. Which will underscore a number of points. This is from Calvin and Hobbes, which is my favorite. And it's also really quite nice for linguistic analysis sometimes, or for linguistic facts. And I think this makes the point here, or underscores it. Explain Newton's first law of motion in your own words. Yaka fu mok, etc., etc. I love loopholes. Okay. So, taking in your own words quite literally. We will return to this cartoon when we talk about pragmatics again. Okay. Right. Is all human language arbitrary? Quite obviously not, because we have words like jingle, hiccup, swoosh, snore. Snore is? Yeah, okay. Crash. There seems to be something about those words which say something about what they mean. Okay. I'm sure you will have heard of onomatopoeia or onomatopoetic words, and this is what we're talking about now. So this is really where the form, where there's a level of iconicity in the words where the word is actually related to the meaning of it. Okay. But I think it's still important to ask whether even those words are not to some extent arbitrary. Can you tell me what a rooster says in English and in German? A rooster in English says cock-a-doodle-doo, right? Mm-hmm. And in German? Kikeriki, yeah, that's pretty different. Okay. And those roosters speak the same language. Okay. That makes an important point, I think. This will be too small, I think, for you to see, but this is different languages and the kind of words these languages use to express the barking of a dog. Okay. And it can be really quite dramatically different. In English, we've got woof, arf, or, well, bark, bark, etc. And we've got, let's see what other examples, in Catalan. Any Catalan speakers here? It's something like, I don't know, boop, boop, or... I don't know how to pronounce it, which makes another point. This is, what is this? It's supposed to be read like as if it was English, okay? But anyway, we'll come back to that. Finnish, how? I don't know. Anyway, so there are clearly some similarities, but to some extent we can say that these words have been arbitrarily conventionalized, okay? So yes, they are onomatopoetic, but they are still... localized to whatever language we are talking about. So this isn't really a strong argument against non-arbitrariness. Okay. Right, those were the six, if I counted correctly, those were the six features of human interaction or of human communication, of the system of human communication, that seem to be unique or to a very, very large extent unique to human interaction and cannot be found in animal communication. Maybe those six features can help us better understand what human communication is like. I'd like to move on now, and this is a little bit of a sort of detour because it'll allow me to mention a few points that are relevant for next week and the following week's lecture on phonetics and phonology. Because I'd like to ask the question what the connection is between pronunciation and spelling. Okay. English spelling is a mess, right? We know that. Right? Would anyone like to pronounce this or to read it off? Okay. I'll just let everyone read this for themselves. Okay. And you can quite clearly see that what we have here is, well, whether you want to call it a mess or not, it's quite clearly sounds and the letters used to represent those sounds are not 100%, well, not even 100% here, well, far from it, correlated. If you're learning a language, this can be problematic, but even if you're a native speaker of English, you may encounter problems in spelling, and many English native speakers feel that they are not good at spelling. About 4 years ago, I moved over from Switzerland to the northwest of England, along with my children, and my then 8-year-old son wrote the following note to me once when I got home from work, or had written that for me. Okay? You should be looking for my Game Boy. Okay. Because I had promised to him that I would be looking for it, and I apparently hadn't done it, and it still wasn't around, so he was annoyed and wrote me that message. Okay. Now, the interesting point is that he had very, very few, and very quickly, very, very few problems reading English, okay, reading it aloud, okay, but producing it in terms of actually writing it down seemed to be, first of all, a largely unrelated task, but also much more difficult for him. Okay. And that's, as I said, a sentiment that's shared by many native speakers. Here's a quote from someone who feels that it's embarrassing that they are not as good at spelling as they should be. It's embarrassing, very embarrassing in so many ways. For instance, if I sent the kid to a shop, I can't write out what I need. I can't spell. I'm a nice writer, but I can't spell. Or this quote actually makes the point that this could be an impediment to finding a good job. I went for a job as an ambulance driver, and the writing and spelling let me down. It stops me getting a better job, a more secure one. Okay. So it seems to be almost like a gatekeeper for people, the way they can, or a gatekeeper for sort of certain social circles. Okay. Let's ask a simple question. How many vowels does English have? Any guesses?
Yeah.
Five. Okay. You mean these? Yeah. Not quite. Okay. I'll ask you again in 2 weeks' time. Okay. Yeah. But yes, it has five vowels when, and that's probably what you meant. It has five vowels in terms of the spelling system. Okay. The alphabet that we use. But to what extent does this actually refer or reflect the reality in terms of production? Okay, and there, it's actually quite different. Okay. English spelling is, and this is a word that you do not know yet, is not fully phonemic. That is, there is no one-to-one correspondence between sound and letters. And I'll come back to that later. Can you think, and this is the little breather that I would like to introduce in the middle of the lecture, can you think of words that are spelt with an A, but that have different realizations from an acoustic point of view? So, that's actually the opposite. This is the symbol that we will use next week for the sound sh. Can you think of words that use the same sound but are spelt differently? Okay. Just for 2 minutes, and you can chat with your neighbor if you want and take a breather. Okay, break's over. That was a short break, I know. Okay, any words spelt with A but sounding different? Yeah. Sorry? Okay, yes, it's, yeah, okay. There's an A in there, but you don't really hear the sound. Yeah, okay, that's even further than I was one. Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah. Exactly, so we've got wash, oh, and car, as in ah, okay. I've got a few here. Cat, base, bath, or as the people in Northern England would say, bath, but that's something different, okay. Water, wall, about, cottage, okay. So quite some variation here. And for sh, the list is even longer. Okay. We've got sugar, schist, issue, mansion, mission, conscious, ocean, suspicion, and chaperone. Okay, always the same sound, but spelled in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different ways. Okay, so quite clearly, the correlation between spelling and pronunciation is not direct. How strong it is a different question. How irregular English spelling really is a different question. Well, how irregular is it? And again, as so often in linguistics, it depends on how you count. Okay. If you look at a text and you count all the words that are spelled irregularly in the sense of that there is a mismatch between pronunciation and spelling, then you will find quite a few. However, many of those that you will find will be repeated words. They will be words that are very frequent and therefore very often occur in a text, in a normal text. Okay. There are really only about 400, let's call them everyday words, normal words that are part of the stock of words that can be used in normal situations, conversations that you will have with your friends, etc. Only about 400 words are really wholly irregular. The problem is that most of them are very frequent, and that gives us the impression that spelling is much more irregular than it really is. And this gives me the first opportunity to mention something which will come back, which I'll come back to, for example, in week 15, but maybe also throughout the rest of the lecture course. It's this distinction between types and tokens. What do I mean? Well, a type is, or let's say a token, let's start with a token. A token is each instance of a word in a page of text, let's say. Okay. But as I said, some of those words may be repeated. They may be the same type. It may just be tokens of the same type. Okay. And if one word, like the, which is the most frequent word in the language, occurs 6 times per 100 words, then the token frequency is high, but it's really only one type. And some people, or many people, use the ratio between type and token to, for example, say something about lexical diversity in a text, how dense the vocabulary is, etc. Okay. So you will, from time to time, see something like the type-token ratio being mentioned. Okay. Yeah. So in terms of types, there aren't all that many that are fully irregular. But in terms of tokens, there are a lot. Okay. We will later on, when we do morphology, come back to something very similar, namely the distinction between lexeme and word form. Okay. The word form is how a particular word is realized, but there are 3 or 4 different realizations of the same verb. For example, sing, sings, singing, and sang. They relate to one particular lexeme. But more of that later on. Okay, spelling and accent. There is a relationship there, too. Some accents seem to be closer to standard spelling than others. Okay. How do people pronounce those two words in different areas? Okay. Well, if you are in Britain, in the Southeast, Midlands, Wales, and Northern England, in most cases, in Northern England, they will be pronounced in exactly the same way. Sought. Yeah? The sort of thing he sought. Well, I can't do this very well in isolation. Okay. But if you are in the southwest, in Cornwall, for example, or up north in Scotland and in Ireland, and in fact somewhere close to where I used to live in Lancaster, in East Lancashire, then you will produce the R, the post-vocalic R. You will say something like sort, okay, as the Americans do. This is called the rhotic R. Okay. So we could say that those areas are actually closer to spelling when it comes to this word. Pronunciation and spelling are closer. Another example, which and which I've just pronounced identically. Well, Most areas of the British Isles will do that, pronounce them identically. But, and you haven't learned all those symbols yet, but as you can see, there is something different here. In fact, in Scotland, they will audibly produce something like which, or even which. Okay. Usually there are historical explanations for things like that. Okay. Now, historical explanations can also be brought forward for explaining what's going on in terms of much of what we have in present-day English spelling. What happened in Old English 1,000 years ago, more than 1,000 years ago? Well, they took over the Latin letters, plus a few extra letters. Okay, but let's not go into detail here. The problem was that this was still not enough to cover all the sounds. There were about 40 vowels and consonants in use at the time. So they had to be inventive. And their way of doing this was to introduce what's known as digraphs. Okay. For example, sheep, which was then pronounced shape. Okay. But it was written, it was spelt with two letters. So even though it is only one sound, there was no single letter available which would correspond to this, so there was a convention to use two letters to do this. Okay. Edge, same thing. All right? Further digraphs were introduced later on in the Middle Ages. For example, what used to be C followed by W became what we nowadays use, namely QU. Okay. And there are a couple of others, partly motivated, actually, by the way they were pronounced, because right was actually pronounced Richt. Richt. Okay. Or there's the Huet, which became WH. Okay. It's not the only reason for change. One reason was actually whether it was able, whether people were able to read it. Have a look at this. Can you read this? If you're trained, you can. Okay. But that's because there were a number of letters that were written in a very, very similar fashion, namely those here. Okay. And what happened if you had letters next to each other that were very similar in form? Like in love or sun in its Old English or Middle English forms. Or wolf. So W and U next to each other would just basically be a succession of vertical strokes. Okay. And that's why, some people say, certain words were actually changed in the way they were spelled to make them more legible. Okay. There's not that much difference between O and U, but it made a big difference in terms of reading. Okay. Another important aspect in making let's say standardizing what we have today was, of course, the printing press, which was introduced to England towards the end of the Middle Ages, 1476. And before that, even after for a long time, before that there was a huge variety of spelling. Okay. Spelling differences. This is the word sort. Okay. This is the word sort from the Oxford English Dictionary, because the Oxford English Dictionary also lists spelling variants at different times in the history of the word. And the numbers in front of the word relate to the centuries where these variants are found. So I didn't count them, but you can see that there are a number of rather massive differences that will no doubt reflect dialectal differences in pronunciation to some extent. Now, obviously, through printing brought over, as I said, in 1476, the distribution of the same spelling throughout the country will have had an influence on how people learned to spell. Okay. In fact, it had also, and this is a really minor influence, it also had an influence in the sense that the printers basically decided how to spell things sometimes. For example, the Old English for ghost had no H, but because the printers were actually often Flemish, where it was spelled with a GH, they basically introduced it to England, and it got stuck there. In fact, some spelling irregularities may actually go back to the fact that they wanted to fill the whole line. Now, nowadays, a computer can do this very easily. Back then, they couldn't, so they just added a few letters occasionally. Okay. Another important, and you may have heard of this fact, was the Great Vowel Shift, 15th to the 18th century, roughly, and that resulted, among other things, into the fact that we nowadays in English don't have A, E, I, O, U, but A, I, etc., etc. Okay. Now, this may not make perfect sense to you yet, but this is basically what we're going to see next week, namely a representation of the mouth, the internal sort of speech organs, and where vowels are produced. And you can see that the arrows, you can see that things changed. What was here became higher up. What was up couldn't go higher, went central, and became something like, for example, I or O, etc. So this is quite a dramatic change in pronunciation. It resulted in major changes throughout, it was also important for other languages, but obviously particularly for British English here in this context. If you want to read up more on this, here's a link for you. But what this basically means is, because if I say 15th to 18th century, this is after the time of printing being introduced. This is after quite a lot had already been standardized. Okay. Which basically means that modern spelling as we know today still in some way reflects what Chaucer in the 14th century will have spoken like. Okay. Another way to fix spelling was dictionaries, which became very important quite late. 500 years, there were no dictionaries. Okay. There were no grammars and there were no dictionaries. In 1755, there is Samuel Johnson's dictionary, which was extremely influential, and it resulted in the further fixing of the standard. And people were very confused at that time, but it resulted in further standardization. Now, I've already mentioned etymological spelling briefly. Language. Why is language spelled the way it is? This is how it was originally spelled when it entered the language in Middle English, namely without the U. But nowadays, we spell it with a U. Why? Well, because someone decided, well, not one single person, but because people decided this is a word of Latinate origin, and therefore we should spell it like a Latin word, and there is a U after the G in lingua. Okay. Debt. Okay. There is debitum, there is a B in there, therefore there must be a B, even though it is nowadays a silent B, even though it was probably back then, it was never a debtor or something like that. Okay. Receipt. Why is there a P before the T? Well, because in Latin we've got receptum. Salmon. Okay, it's not salmon, it's salmon. Well, in Latin there is an L, so therefore let's write it with an L. Even island. Okay. Or scissors. Now, we will be talking more about borrowing when we talk about the lexicon in a later lecture. But a few words here. There were lots of words borrowed into the English language in the 16th and the 17th centuries, and we've got words like this that are spelled differently from normal words of English. Let's call them normal. Bizarre, grotesque, gazette, moustache, intrigue. Okay. Also, more recently, from languages like Japanese, kamikaze. Okay. How many words are there that start with a K in English? Very, very few. And in fact, look at the words that the most frequent words in the British National Corpus that start with a KA. Okay. Most of them, well, all of them are borrowings, okay. Which suggests that there is possibly more regularity because some of the irregularity is influenced by external processes or by words being borrowed into the language. Okay. Some people have tried to bring order into this chaos, and they came up with spelling rules, and children at British schools sometimes learn about these rules. Okay. Correspondence rules, they're called, etc. No, I do not want you to learn them, by the way. Okay. This is just basic information. There is no need to know that there is a rule like this. Spelling IG before M or N corresponds to the sound I, as in design. Okay. Don't learn this bit by heart. It's more the principle that people try to understand the apparent chaos. There are many problems with those rules. Here's another one, which would explain field, receive, and ceiling, but it doesn't explain society, efficient, and species. So they only go to go as far as, well, many words, but not most, not even most words. In fact, beige and foreign and way don't work with this either. Okay. Another way to go about understanding this is to say, all right, there are distribution rules. Words do not end in the letters I, J, K, Q, U, V, or a single Z, unless they are distinctly foreign. Okay? Remember the word that I introduced before, which was clearly borrow. Okay, now, as I said, you don't need to know all of these aspects and details in by heart. I'm more interested in the general principles. And one of those questions, basically, is whether we can decide and how we can decide whether there is a correct way of using spelling or of spelling. Okay. Now, for English, unlike for German, there is no official body that regulates how things are spelt and how things are, or how texts are punctuated. Okay. Who decides and on what grounds? Okay. We have things like tradition, but possibly we could also say frequency is an important part. Okay. If something is spelt very frequently in a particular way, maybe we should accept this as a standard. Okay. Here is a longish quote from someone who is working in the dictionary making business. Where two variants are common, we, that is Longman, give the most frequent first and separate them by a comma, where one is far less frequent than the other. For example, jail and jail. Did you know that jail could be spelled J-A-O-U-L? Okay. It's no longer a very frequent one. We separate them by also. As we are now entirely a product of ELT, English language teaching dictionaries, we depart from this convention to show a world English spelling shared by British and American English before a purely or predominantly British one. So although inquire is three times as frequent as inquire in the written part of the British National Corpus, we give inquire as our main form, and we give economize with an S as a variant spelling of economize with a Z, although it is the spelling of 3 out of 5 B and C entries. Okay. Now, what this shows is that what's standard on the British Isles may no longer be standard on a worldwide scale, but it also means that what is more frequent should perhaps be given the default status. It's also possible to deviate from spelling on purpose. Have a look at this one. Singular. Okay? It's a nice brand name. Or marvelous. Okay? Or, I don't know how many of you know dim sum. It's actually not dim sum. There's another one with dim sum, but I didn't have this. Sorry, this is not about dim sum, which is Chinese. This is actually about Scottish shortbread. So, don't worry. This eat some more, same thing. Okay? Eat some more. Okay. Now, what we have here are deliberate deviations from the norm in order to get across something to the readers, to be noticeable. And in fact, they are now so common that sometimes they are even overlooked because we have become so used to them. It seems important to recognize that innovative spelling in trade names is at present so widespread that many instances of it hardly strike the reader at all. Indeed, the use of certain types of unconventional spelling has become almost a convention in itself, its function seeming to signal that the item concerned is in fact a trade name. Okay. A really nice example of this, I think, is the greengrocer's apostrophe. I don't know whether you've come across this. 1 hour photos. Why is this spelt with an apostrophe? Why an apostrophe here? Tiles, toilets, and tools. Why with tools and not, okay? And taps, okay? No dogs with an apostrophe, okay? And I particularly like this one, don'ts and do's. But it is really, I mean the greengrocer's apostrophe, apples and oranges and things like that, are so accepted nowadays that it's actually not considered wrong spelling by many people. Okay. Another way to deliberately deviate from the norm for a particular purpose is this one. Well, we all know how to spell school, don't we? And if we want to deliberately deviate from it to make a point, then we would probably not do this, okay? Because it's too far removed. But we could do this, okay, with a K. School is close enough to be recognizable as a representation of the word school, but at the same time, it defiantly refuses to conform to the standard spelling norm for this word, okay? And probably makes your teacher angry, okay? It's a statement. Okay, so you can actually use spelling to make a statement about your attitudes or your political views. Okay, I'm being subversive. Here's an example which really has political dimensions. K is a very rare grapheme or letter in Spanish. Okay. But it is very common in Basque. And many of you will know that there is traditionally a problem between Spain and the Basques. Okay? Now, very often you see graffiti with the word ocupado. I don't speak Spanish, but I know that you do not spell ocupado in Spanish with a K. Okay? And by spelling it with a K, you don't only make the point that you feel occupied, but it actually transmits more in terms of a Basque identity. Okay. It's a suitable icon for otherness. Okay. So it's in opposition to the political mainstream. Okay. A quick quote here. My sense is that within radical youth culture, these parodic hybrid spellings create a kind of symbolic allegiance with Basque oppositionality, which allows youth to simultaneously use Spanish while distancing themselves from any associations it has with state power and hegemony. So some people have talked about orthography as a social practice. Okay. Now that was a long detour into spelling. Okay, and no, just to say again, to point out again, you do not need to know all those details. Okay, it is mainly meant to give you a bit of background for understanding the lecture on sounds and on phonetics and phonology next time. Now, I'd like to finish off with a few facts about English and with a few comments about different ways of doing linguistics. Now, we all know about certain facts, or let's call them myths instead. For example, we know that America is ruining English, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Prince Charles seems to think so. Okay, Prince Charles, 1995, reported in the Times. He's commenting on American English. It is very corrupting. People tend to invent all sorts of nouns and verbs and make words that shouldn't be. We must act now to ensure that English, and that, to my way of thinking, means English, maintains its position as the world language well into the next century. Okay. Can I just have a brief exercise for you, or can I just ask you to do this? These are all words that are in British English today. Which one of them have come from American English, if any? Okay, any answers? Any at all? Yeah. Blurb and snazzy, yes. Jazz, yes, true, yes. More? All right, let's cut it short. All of them, yeah? All of them, okay. All of them are American, well, seem to have been created using word formation processes, or seem to have been borrowed into possibly American English and then moved over to British English. And I'm sure some of them are used by Prince Charles as well. And I think this shows that we can sometimes have very wrong perceptions about how language is used or about facts of language. One of those facts is also that, of course, written language is best. Okay? This is a key folk belief which has many parallels or sort of which spawns off many other myths. Okay? Language is in writing. Good pronunciation follows writing. Well, I think we've already seen enough to show that this is nonsense. Good grammar follows writing. Children should be taught the grammar of writing. Variation is bad because, well, in writing there is less variation. There is variation, but it's less than in spoken dialects. And of course, change is bad, as we all know. Okay? And that's possibly related to the fact that written language tends to be much more permanent, of course. Here's a brief extract from a Lancaster exam script that I once had to grade. It is a fact that in the 20th century, the working class were completely illiterate and communicated with each other in a very simplistic manner, not recognizable as speech. I think the student hasn't understood certain concepts. Yes, okay. This is clearly very judgmental language, and very often when we talk about these sort of myths or what people think are facts about language, we use this kind of very emotional, judgmental vocabulary. Okay. We, of course, have good versus bad, but we've got simplistic, sloppy, lazy, careless. Someone who talks or writes like that can't possibly be a good person. Okay. Impoverished, etc. And even the word illiterate, of course. Okay. Now, people who tend to bemoan the decay of the language and who tend to think that writing is best, etc., tend to be associated with the prescriptive approach. Okay? And this is the idea, and I'm sure some of you, or many of you, will have heard this before, that one particular variety, let's call it standard English, or one particular way of speaking, let's say the way Prince Charles speaks, okay, or the Queen, has an inherently higher value than others. And the value is actually determined by beliefs about what counts as prestigious. So, in writing, it would have been for a long time Latin. Okay. And how language works. Okay. For example, by the principles of logic. We cannot have a double negative. That's not logical. Right? In mathematics, two negatives make a positive. Okay. So, I can't get no satisfaction doesn't work, because that means he can. Okay? Or she. Anyway, it was Rolling Stones, wasn't it? Certain varieties or features are prescribed, that is, you have to do this, they have to be followed. Others are proscribed, namely prohibited, or in other words, prohibited, to be avoided. Okay? So we've got the do's and the don'ts. And notice that I put the apostrophe. There's no apostrophe. Okay. Then there's the descriptive approach. Descriptive approach, well, it does what it says, it describes. It's the idea that a task of the linguist is not to judge, not to say what's good or bad, but to observe and to describe. To describe the facts which are, visible in observing it or following certain experimentation techniques, etc. Now, if you're interested in more language myths and would like to read up on this, there's some really nice and easy reading, very enjoyable information in the following book, Language Myths. Okay. I'll give you a couple of titles here. French is a logical language. Okay? We all know that. Women talk too much. Yeah. Some languages have no grammar. Black children are verbally deprived. You shouldn't say it is me because me is accusative. TV makes people sound the same, etc. So they take all those myths and they show how this is linked up to language and how it is actually produced and used in society. And then they debunk those myths and go at it from a descriptive point of view. The kind of linguistics that we do here in Trier very often, not constantly, but very often, is corpus linguistics. And I've already mentioned some findings last week when I talked about who uses lovely, elderly ladies, etc. And this is based on, description. We're describing what other people have said. We're describing what we find in a large collection of authentic language used. Okay? We're describing those patterns that we see in the data. Okay? But more of that later in term, namely, definitely in lecture 15, which is a whole lecture on corpus linguistics, but you'll get the occasional bit from me throughout the lecture course. And that means that I'm 8 minutes early. See you next Friday.